in our study this morning, in 1 Kings chapter 18 and 19, you have studied Wednesday night, Richard told me, about the prophet Elijah, the contest on Mount Carmel, how that he brought together the prophets of Baal and challenged them to call upon their God to consume the offering that they had prepared. And I'm sure you talked about how that they were made fun of by Elijah, and how that they cut themselves with knives and lances, and that, of course, contrary to the law of Moses, as they were not to inflict those kind of things upon themselves. You can read about that, and probably did, back in Leviticus chapter 19, and I'm sure that you made the point, Richard, that they did this all day long, until the evening oblation. And then Elijah called upon God once, and God sent fire from heaven, consumed the altar, the offering, licked up the water that was in the ditch. And I find it interesting, as it also tells us that in verse 38, and the stones and the dust. Now, fire that consumes a stone is a hot fire, and that's what God sent and consumed the offering that Elijah had prepared. Now, that sets the stage for the things that we want to talk about in our study this morning from the 19th chapter, where we learn that Elijah is told by Jezebel that your life will be as their life by this time tomorrow. In other words, Jezebel is saying that by this time tomorrow, I'm going to see to it that you're dead. Now, Elijah ran away and very much discouraged. And I find this passage interesting for a lot of reasons, because discouragement is a reality of life. And sometimes we become pretty down about things, don't we? And maybe at times you felt like Elijah did, as we read in verse 3. It says, "And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. He said, It is enough now, O Jehovah. Take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers." Elijah is so down that he'd just rather give up. Now, one of the things that sometimes puts us in such a state of mind is the feeling of loneliness. And no doubt, Elijah felt like that he was alone. But we need to remember back over in the 18th chapter that Jezebel had made a proclamation that all the prophets of God be killed. And it was Obadiah that took 100 of those prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. You see that in chapter 18, verse 4. Now, Elijah, did he know that? Well, Obadiah told him that. In fact, you'll note that in verse 8, it says of chapter 18, "And he answered him, It is I, go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And he said, Wherein have I sinned that thou wouldest deliver thy servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me? As Jehovah thy God liveth, there is no nation or kingdom, whether my Lord hath not sent to seek thee. And when they said, He is not here, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation that they found thee not. And now thou sayest, Go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And it came, or it will come to pass, as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of Jehovah will carry thee whether I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find thee, he will slay me. But I, thy servant, fear Jehovah from my youth. Was it not told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of Jehovah, how I hid 100 men of Jehovah's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. Now, again, the question, did Elijah know what Obadiah the prophet had done? Did Elijah then know that there were, in fact, other prophets that were serving the Lord? Yes, he knew that. But you know, sometimes, in spite of what we know, we kind of blind ourselves to that. Though Elijah has been told that there are other prophets, and though he knows of Obadiah's faithfulness, even to risk his life to save the lives of the prophets, that Elijah feels alone. And if you'll notice in the text, it tells us his desire to die. Now in verse 5, going back to chapter 19, it tells us that he lay down and slept under a juniper tree, and behold, an angel touched him, and said unto him, Arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. And the angel of Jehovah came again the second time and touched him and said, Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he arose and did eat and drink and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the mount of God. Now, I have a map, I believe, right there it is, that will help us, I think, to see just a little bit about where some of these places are. Now, notice, first of all, when the drought began. How long did the drought last?
3.5 years.
3.5 years. When the drought began, what did God do with Elijah? He said, go over here to the brook Cherith, and the ravens will provide food for you. All right? The drought continued. What happened to the brook? It dried up. Then what did Elijah do? He went to Zarephath. Remember the widow of Zarephath? But now the drought is all up in there too. What's her problem? She's about ready to die. No, she has just a little bit of meal left in the jar, a little bit of oil, and she's preparing to make some food so that she and her son can eat and just lay down and die. This is to be their last meal. And while Elijah is there, what does he promise her? All right, it's never going to run out. The jar of meal is not going to get empty, and the oil is not going to run out. And so you go and prepare a cake, but you prepare one for me first. And so she did, and she continued to have food to eat. But then what happened? Her son got sick and died, and Elijah the prophet restored him to life. And these events all happened in Zarephath. And then we learn this contest in Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal. As a result, these prophets of Baal and Asherah are all put to death. And then it begins to rain. And Ahab is instructed by the prophet to flee down from the mountain so that you don't get caught up here with the rain. And where does Ahab go?
Jezreel.
He goes to Jezreel. Where does Elijah go?
Jezreel.
And we find that it's at Jezreel that Elijah finds out that Jezebel intends to kill him. And so he flees down here to Beersheba, some distance, you see, to get away from Jezebel so she won't kill him. Now, at Beersheba, it's in this area that he crawls up under a juniper tree and wishes he was dead. And then the angel of the Lord tells him twice to awake and eat so that he can be sustained. Now, where is it that Elijah is going? He's going to Mount Horeb. Now, all I did with our map here is put an arrow on that. You may recall that when we were studying of the escape of the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, there were questions about the location of Mount Horeb. There is the traditional route of the exodus of the children of Israel that brings them across the Gulf of Suez, a portion of that,
over into what was later identified as the Sinai Peninsula. And we talked about all of that. We talked about the location, the traditional location of Mount Sinai down toward the southern end of that peninsula. But we also looked at an alternate route of the children of Israel as they came up out of Egypt that would indicate that they came across over at the Gulf of Aqaba, indicating that Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai would be on the western or the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba. But at any rate, I want you to see that it, with this scale of miles, it would put it way down here. So the point is, Elijah had a long way to go. And in order to get there, he needs sustenance. And he's provided that here in this text, that he might go to Mount Horeb. Verse 8 is where we are in chapter 19, 1 Kings. Yes?
If you think about it, the Israelites made kind of the reverse journey, and it took them 40 years.
Yeah, well, yes. It took them 40 years because of disbelief on their part. They were not privileged to enter in. But this area, as we get down south of the Dead Sea and a little bit west of the Dead Sea, we've discussed that in our topographical maps and noted that it is extreme rugged terrain. And this is the area that Elijah went during this time. Now, I want to pick it up there at verse 9. Keep in mind now that Elijah is discouraged. He's run away. And in verse 9 it says, he came thither into the cave, or unto a cave, and lodged there. And behold, the word of Jehovah came to him, and he said unto him, what doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for Jehovah, the God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. You talk about low on the totem pole, as we use that expression. Elijah is feeling very low, very lonely in his efforts to serve the Lord. And in verse 11 it says that God said to him, go forth and stand upon the mount before Jehovah. And behold, Jehovah passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before Jehovah. But Jehovah was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but Jehovah was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but Jehovah was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. Now let's try to recall some events that have occurred at this location in times gone by. When we think of Mount Horeb, what mountain is, or what name is more common in our thinking? Mount Sinai. All right. Now, whether we are right in the precise location of where Mount Sinai is or not, we know what happened there. What happened there? All right, Moses went upon the mount and received the law, received the tablets of stone. Now, why didn't all the people go up on that mount? What was going on around the mount and on the mount? You mean some similar events to what we're reading here? Yes. But God did not speak through these events. We know, and I find it interesting in the footnote, at least the reading of the American Standard Translation, after the earthquake of fire, verse 12, but Jehovah was not in the fire, and after the fire, a still small voice. But the footnote says, sound of gentle stillness. That's interesting to me.
The American Standard says, after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing.
Okay. Would be quite a contrast, is I think the point that's being made. Here are some grand events that are taking place when you think of the earthquake and you think of the wind that rent the mountains and when you think of the fire, and then you have quiet. Quiet. And in the quiet, God said, what doest thou here, Elijah? And then in verse 14, he said, this is the second time, I have been very jealous for Jehovah, the God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Now, when you think of discouragement, Elijah wishes that he was dead. Elijah wants to hide. He feels alone. And God has asked him a second time, why are you here? Now, what does that indicate to you? Is that where God wants him to be? Now, keep in mind, as you look at this map, a lot of the events that are taking place up here in Israel. The cause is idolatry. We've got prophets of Baal and prophets of the female counterpart, Asherah. And Elijah is going about as far away from that as he can get and hiding in a cave. And what does God then tell him to do? Verse 15, look at your Bible. All right. Return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. Now, where is Damascus?
Up there where that circle
just came in. You're good, aren't you? Yeah. I ought to put a bullseye on that. You see, what's Elijah going to have to do to get from way down here to way up here? He's going to have to go right back through all this mess, isn't he? Now, I want you to think about that for just a moment. God has something in mind for Elijah to do. You're not ready to die yet. There's still something for you to do, and something for you to do about this idolatry. Look, if you will, in verse 15. It says, and when thou comest, thou shalt anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. Now that's important because Hazael is not now king over Syria. Who is? Ben-Hadad is king over Syria. Well, the fact that Elijah is going to anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. What do we know, even as we've studied ahead, but even here, by implication, what's going to happen to Ben-Hadad? He's not going to live. That's right. Everything's going to be taken away. And he says, I want you to appoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel. Now, Jehu's not king over Israel yet. Who is? Ahab. What then, by implication, is going to happen to Ahab? He's not going to make it either. And if you look next in the text, it says, and it shall come to pass, verse 16, it says, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, shalt thou appoint to be prophet in thy room. I understand this, in thy stead or in thy place. What's that say by implication about Elijah? You're not going to make it either. Now, there is a difference, of course, and we're going to talk about that. We know how that Elijah did not die. He was taken up in a fiery chariot. But as we think about Ben-Hadad and Ahab, they met with some awful things that resulted in their demise. How was that for diplomacy? So what we want to note in this is Elijah has a great deal of work to do before the end of his journey on this earth. Now, he needs to be reminded of something. In verse 17, look at your Bible. It says, and it shall come to pass that him that escapeth from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay. And him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. What about all these idolatrous practices and the prophets of Baal and Asherah? What's going to happen to them? Well, they're going to be destroyed. That's right. Now, if Hazael doesn't do it, Jehu will. And if he don't, Elisha will. But the idea is this judgment is going to be complete. Do you see that? So, no, don't feel like that you're all alone. And don't feel like that those who are practicing idolatry have become in some way the victors. That's not true. In fact, he says in verse 18, Yet will I leave, meet 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. In other words, Elijah, you're not alone. Now you may feel alone. And I'll tell you, in times of feeling alone, it can be very discouraging, such as the case here with Elijah. Old gospel preacher, I believe his name was J.D. Tand, said that at sometimes he felt like that only he and his wife were going to be the ones to go to heaven. And he said, frankly, sometimes I worry about her. Now, sometimes you feel alone. And the judgments that you make to serve the Lord, you think, well, nobody's thinking right on this. And you feel alone. But yet, there is work to do. Elijah had work to do, and he needed to be reminded that he was not alone. That there were others who were serving God. And that was to be a source of encouragement to him. And those who were not serving God, they would not be the victors. Yes.
Looking at the map, I think, just bear with me, I'm talking something out in my head.
I understand, do it all the time.
But when the angel of the Lord came to Elijah where he was about a day's journey away from Beersheba, he gave him food and said, "Arise and eat because the journey is too great for you." And on the strength of that food, he traveled for 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Horeb. It doesn't seem like the angel told him where to go, because when he got there, God said, "Why are you here?" So the angel gave him sustenance to get up to 40 days away. If he had chosen to go where he was needed, he could have made it to the wilderness of Damascus.
You're right.
On that food.
It's an interesting observation. Yeah. Yeah. I had not thought of that, but that's right. Very good observation.
You kind of did a Jonah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we have no evidence that he told you that before you left.
Well, no. That's true. But this is the instructions of the Lord for him. You don't need to be here. You need to be there. There's work for you to do. Now, think of what Elijah has already been through. When we look at this contest of chapter 18, you'll note previous to the contest, it says in verse 19, "Now therefore send," this is chapter 18, verse 19, "Now send and gather to me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal, 450, and the prophets of the Asherah, 400 that eat at Jezebel's table." Now these prophets were killed. Can you imagine how long it took to kill that many people? But how alone you might feel when that's your task. Destroying the evil out of the land of Israel. Now, let's keep in mind, when Elijah gets down into here, where is he? We don't have the division of the kingdom marked on this map, but Beersheba, is that in Judah or is that in Israel?
Judah.
That's in Judah. That's right. All right, that's right. So what we have, he's escaped the idolatry up here. What's going on down here? Now we know that Asa is king during a portion of this time. What's going on down there? Oh, he's a good king. That's right. He's a good king. So things are good during a portion of this time. I said Asa, Jehoshaphat. We'll talk about that more when we discuss Jehoshaphat. But at this point, at least, things are good in Judah. Now, I want to go back to our previous chart. This one. Elijah flees from Jezebel to Beersheba and on to Horeb. He later anoints Elisha, who is to, in essence, take his place. The thing I wanted to observe over here is that the prophets during the time of Ahab, we've not talked about Micaiah all that much,
Elijah, Elisha, and Micaiah. We'll talk about him more when we talk about Jehoshaphat, because Ahab doesn't like Micaiah. He never says anything good. And so consequently, I don't like him. We don't want to make any inquiries of him. But now let's get to the next chart from this text and pick up the reading there beginning about verse 19 of chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19. It says, "So he departed thence and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12. And Elijah passed over unto him and cast his mantle upon him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee. And he said unto him, Go back again, for what have I done to thee? And he returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered unto him." Now that just kind of hooks us up between Elijah and Elisha. But the next chain of events are described in chapter 20, beginning in verse 1. "And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his host together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria and fought against it." Now, several things we want to pull out of that context. Let's look again at the map. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. Now, one of the things that we've noted when the children of Israel exited out of Egypt and they came up into this land and began to conquer the land, what did they find to be different about the land of Canaan versus the land of Egypt? Well, let me add a little bit more into the question, and you'll see what I'm asking for. How was the government different?
City-states.
That's right. This land was governed by city-states. You might have a province, such as Syria, that had a number of cities in that province. There might be a king over this city, a king over this city. And we've talked about how that those kings would reach out and hold as much dominion as they could control. Now, when we talk about Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, he's a king of this province. But it tells us that he had 32 kings with him.
Yeah, earlier history, we looked at a little bit, and there were the city states that you're talking about. It was called Syria when they were united because the enemy was coming in to oppose them, and they would unite, those city states would unite together. Of course, later on, they didn't unite state, but they still had their, like, secular king.
All right, that's right.
In the beginning, they were separate identities, but then when it was mentioned the city state of Damascus, the city state of the Hittites.
Yeah,
when the Hittites
come
down, they united together
as Syria. Yeah, that's right. That's a good observation. We need to be aware of that. You remember back during the time of Abraham and Lot, we find that the kings of Mesopotamia gathered together, and they came down here where Lot was in this area and fought against the peoples of this area and took Lot and his family and all back up to Mesopotamia. And when we read about Abraham getting his men together and going up there and fighting against those kings, it's a similar circumstance. You've got kings that band together to form a league against a common enemy. And that's essentially what you have here. Now, Ben-Hadad has 32 kings with him, horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria and fought against it. Now, what's the significance of Samaria?
Capital of Israel.
That's the capital of Israel. That's right. So you see that he's brought his army down here. Note where Samaria is, located in the hill country of Israel, as we sometimes refer to it and did on our topographical map. But read verse 2, if you will, please. Chapter 20, verse 2. "And he sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, into the city, and said unto him, Thus saith Ben-Hadad,
Thy silver and thy gold is mine. Thy wives also and thy children, even the goodliest, are mine. And the king of Israel answered and said, It is according to thy saying, my lord, O king. I am thine and all that I have. Ahab just rolls over, doesn't he? Not even a hint about fighting against Ben-Hadad. We find that Ben-Hadad fights against Samaria, but not much fight in Ahab. You'll note in verse 5, And the messengers came again and said, Thus speaketh Ben-Hadad, saying, I sent indeed unto thee, saying, Thou shalt deliver me thy gold and or silver and thy gold and thy wives and thy children, and I will send my servants unto thee tomorrow about this time, and they shall search thy house and the houses of thy servants, and it shall be that whatsoever is pleasant in thine eyes, they shall put it in their hand and take it away. Now that's interesting. Do you have something that's valuable to you that wouldn't really be of any value to anybody else? Something that's precious to you? Well, you think if somebody came into your house, they might, just by looking around, find what's important to you, whether it's of any value or not. Well, now, what's Ben-Hadad doing? Why do that?
Not only is he conquering the city, as it were, he's looting it.
That's right.
Demoralizing the people.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right. Now, the king of Israel, that would be Ahab, verse 7, called all the elders of the land and said, Mark, I pray you, and see how this man seeketh mischief. For he sent unto me for my wives and for my children and for my silver and my gold, and I denied him not. And all the elders and all the people said unto him, Hearken thou not, neither consent. Wherefore he said unto the messengers of Ben-Hadad, Tell my lord the king all that thou didst send for to thy servant at the first, I will do. But this thing I may not do. And the messengers departed and brought him word again. And Ben-Hadad sent unto him and said, The gods do so unto me and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people that follow me. The king of Israel answered and said, Tell him, let not him that girdeth on his armor boast himself as he that putteth it off. Now, Donna and I were talking about this, and she said, What in the world does that mean? You know, that's kind of like a Mickeyism or a Kentucky expression. Don't count your chickens before they're hatched. Ahab is telling Ben-Hadad, don't stand over there and boast when you're putting your armor on, as if you've already fought the battle and you're taking your armor off. You've not beat us yet. Now, in the text, it says, It came to pass when Ben-Hadad heard his message, as he was drinking, he and the kings in the pavilions, that he said unto his servants, Set yourselves in array. And they set themselves in array against the city. Now, Ben-Hadad thinks this is going to be a no-brainer. You see, because of the vast enormity of my army, I'm going to go down there and I'll just stomp Samaria. It'll be a no-brainer. But it turned into something a whole lot greater than what Ben-Hadad thought. Look, if you will, at verse 13. And behold, a prophet came near unto Ahab, king of Israel. What prophet was it? Pardon me? Well, I don't know. It just says prophet. I don't know who it was. That's a trick question. Yeah. I don't know who it was. It just says that there was a prophet. The point I'm trying to make is there's no evidence that it was Elijah. See, Elijah thought he was by himself. But here's a prophet. And we know there were other prophets, including Obadiah and including Micaiah. But who this prophet was, we're simply not told.
Before you launch into the killing part. So, Hadad says to... That's where Ahab. So, Hadad says, You're going to give me all your stuff. And... Ahab says, okay. And then Ben-Hadad says, and not only are you going to give me your stuff, but we're going to come and take more stuff. And that's when Ahab says, no. Okay.
Yeah. He's consulted with the elders of the people, and they're not willing to give up everything that's precious to them. So he says, no.
He's willing to give in a little bit, but then
Yeah. Now, when this prophet comes to Ahab, he tells Ahab, look at verse 13, thus saith Jehovah, hast thou seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver it into thy hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am Jehovah. Now you look at that carefully. What is it that old Ahab and wicked Jezebel have done to the people of God? Turned them to idols. That's right. All these false prophets turned the people away from God. Now God said, you're on the small end of this thing. You look at the multitude that Ben-Hadad has. You look at the threat that he's made against you. He's going to stomp you into dust. But I'm going to fight this battle for you, so that you might know who I am. Ben-Hadad certainly didn't know. And Ahab obviously didn't know. But this prophet of God's now telling him, you're going to beat the Syrians so that you can know who God is. Now that's not the first time we've seen that, is it? We've seen that a number of times. And we will see that yet many times hereafter. Those of you who have studied with us in the book of Ezekiel know that battle after battle was fought that you might know who God is, and that the Edomites and the Moabites and the other ites might know who God is. Now, when you see God deliver a small, what appears to be defenseless group of people from the hand of an army like the Syrians, then the idea is to know who God is. We saw that repeatedly during the days of the judges. Look at the text again, verse 14. And Ahab said, by whom? And he said, thus saith Jehovah, by the young men and the princes of the provinces. And then he said, who shall begin the battle? And he answered, thou. Mr. King Ahab, you're going to become a military leader whether you want to or not. You're going to lead the young men of Israel in victory against Mr. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, so that you can know who God is. Now look at verse 15. He then mustered the young men and the princes of the provinces, and they were 232. And after them he mustered all the people, all the children of Israel, being 7,000. Wait a minute, how many is it old Ben-Hadad has up here? A bunch. I like your specifics. Yeah, a bunch.
There's 32 kings.
He got 32 kings. Yeah. Yeah, and all of that. And so now we see that Ahab has an army of about 7,000 people. And he's going to go up against Ben-Hadad and all the Syrian army and all the kings that reign within that province. Now, in verse 16, it says, and they went out at noon, but Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions, he and the kings, the 32 kings that helped him. What does it appear that Ben-Hadad is thinking?
We
got this whipped. There's nothing to this. Now, when Ahab said, don't count your chickens before they're hatched, that's a brief paraphrase. Ahab didn't know that God was going to fight the battle for him. But he does now. And if you look at verse 17, and the young men of the princes of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, there are men come out from Samaria. And he said, whether they are come out for peace, take them alive. Or whether they are come out for war, take them alive. And these went out of the city, the young men and the princes of the provinces and the army which followed them. And they slew every one his man, and the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on a horse with horsemen, and the king of Israel went out and smote the horses and chariots and slew the Syrians with great slaughter. Who won?
Israel
did. You think old Ahab's surprised? No, I mean Ahab. You think Ahab is a bit surprised? He shouldn't be. God told him through the prophet, I'm going to whip up on them, and you're going to lead them, you see. But now Ahab hasn't had any confidence in God. He's introduced the practices of idolatry. He hasn't worshipped God. He doesn't know who God is. Do you think he does now? He's beginning to get an idea, I would expect. But if you look further in the text, well, before we move from that, I want you to notice in the latter part of verse 20 that Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on a horse with horsemen. We note that the Israelites smote the horses, the chariots, and the Assyrians with a great slaughter. But Ben-Hadad got away. What should have happened to Ben-Hadad? He should have been killed. Now who let him get away? Head down in a couple of verses. Yes, read verse 22. It says, and the prophet, what prophet? We don't know. The prophet came near to the king of Israel and said unto him, go strengthen thyself and mark and see what thou doest. For at the return of the year, the king of Syria will come up against thee. And the servants of the king of Syria said unto him, their God is a God of the hills. Therefore they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they, and do this thing, take the kings away, every man out of his place, and put captains in their room, and number thee an army like the army that thou hast lost, horse for horse, and chariot for chariot, and we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And he hearkened unto their voice, and did so. I want you to underscore, as you read this in your thinking, the thinking of those who worship idols. God of the mountains, God of the hills, God of the plain, God of the ocean. You see, it depends upon where you live as to the power of your God. It depends upon the place where the battle is fought as to the power of your God. You see, we fought up there in Shechem. And the God of the Israelites, I'm sorry, Samaria, the God of the Israelites is up here in this hill country. And so they just really whooped up on us. So what we need to do is we need to engage them in battle, but we need to do that down here in the plains because they can't beat us down there. So the idea is, Mr. Ben-Hadad, you get your army together, number for number, chariot for chariot, horseman for horseman. In other words, we're going to prove to Israel that we can whip them with the same army, that our God is greater than theirs. Well, let's read on. It says, and it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad mustered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. The children of Israel were mustered and were victualed and went against them. And the children of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of kids. But the Syrians filled the country. Draw me a picture, Randy. Can you beat that? Vittles? Well, I say it that way because that's what it was. Yeah, that's the Kentucky version. In other words, they have their provisions. They have their food and the things that they need. And they're like two little flocks of kids. Now, can you think of anything that's more defenseless than a lamb? A baby lamb. And that's how the Israelite army stands down here at Aphek. And the Syrians filled the country. And it says in verse 28... And a man of God came near and spake unto the king of Israel and said, thus saith Jehovah, because the Syrians have said, Jehovah is a God of the hills, but he is not a God of the valleys. Therefore will I deliver all this great multitude into thy hand, and ye shall know that I am Jehovah. Do you see that again? The Syrians don't know who God is. But old King Ahab hadn't got a good handle on that either, has he?
The Syrians think that God is limited in locality, and He's not. But with the idolatrous thinking of Ahab, he's not far from that either. And he needs to understand who God is. In verse 29, they encamped one, or camped over one over against the other 7 days. And so it was that in the seventh day the battle was joined, and the children of Israel slew of the Syrians 100,000 footmen in one day, but the rest fled to Aphek, the city, or into the city, and the wall fell upon 27,000 men that were left, and Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city into an inner chamber. What's happened to Ben-Hadad's army? All right, it's gone. It's been destroyed. Why was it destroyed? God said it would be. That's right. God's fighting with the Israelites now so that they might know who God is. Now, in verse 31, his servant said unto him, "Behold, now we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Let us, we pray thee, put sackcloth on our loins and ropes upon our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Peradventure, he will save thy life." So what do they do?
Beg for mercy.
They beg for mercy. Yeah.
Long wall. That's a lot of men. That's something even more so than 100,000 slain with a sword.
Yes, it is.
Because this is the God. What they considered the God of the mountains has now come down to the valley and landed a wall on 27,000 men.
He's spoken, hadn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. He has. Well, we'll have to talk about Ben-Hadad. Yes, Donna?
They all saw the power of God.
They did. They did. Sure did. More on that Wednesday night. Okay? Very good.